Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yes. That's right. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. That's the vibe here on the Patrick Madrid Show. 888-914-9149. Taco Tuesday, Cyrus. Don't forget. You already forgot, didn't you? Yeah.
I like
you
tacos.
You got started early.
Every day is Taco Tuesday for me.
That's true. It's Taco Tuesday somewhere. Let's go to Nick in Temecula. Good morning, Nick.
Morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
That's great. So my daughter, both my daughters attend a Catholic school, and my oldest daughter, Hermione, in her religious class, the teacher is teaching that Adam and Eve are a parable. Is that correct?
No, it's not. Adam and Eve are real historical people. So simply put, no, that's not true.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Yeah, well, thank you for your answer. I'm gonna relay your answer, and we'll replay your recording later because I know it repeats back on the website every day, doesn't it? In the evenings.
Yes, it airs at least once. As far as I know, it's once, and then of course you can listen at your leisure on the Relevant Radio app or at the page, the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. So it's readily available after about an hour when the show is over. It'll be available to you. All right, Nick, glad I could help. And for those who are interested, if you want some background, if you want something that you can, you know, look at to see what does the church teach on this issue, for that matter, what did Jesus say on this issue? A couple of good books. One is called Free from All Error by Father William Most, M-O-S-T. He was a biblical scholar, taught at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa for many years. I knew him briefly near the end of his life. And that book is an explication of the church's teaching on the inerrancy of Scripture. And that extends to things like the historicity of personages such as Adam and Eve or Noah or Jonah. He also wrote a book called Catholic Apologetics Today, and he covers many different topics, but that's one of them. How do we understand and what are we supposed to believe about people like Noah or Adam and Eve and others in the Old Testament? Were they real people? Did they really exist? Or are these just stories? So he takes the tools of biblical scholarship to these questions, and he demonstrates the church's teaching on this issue. So if you want a very unambiguous explanation of that. Now, for that matter, a number of articles and things have appeared in the Catholic Answers publications. Their website is catholic.com. So if you wanted to do a little bit of keyword searching, you'd find more information there. But those two books by Father William Most would be very helpful. Let's go now to Joanne in Emerald Isle, North Carolina. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning, Patrick, and a blessed Taco Tuesday to you and your team.
Thank you.
My dilemma is, I'm with my sisters here. I'm from a large family. Five of us have gathered together for a week. And we're all brought up in the faith. We're all Catholic. But my older sister belongs now to the Episcopal Church for her reason. So come on Pentecostal Sunday, she wanted to go to the Episcopal Church. And I said, no, I'm going to the Catholic Church. Find a Catholic church. Mm-hmm. St. Mildred's in Emerald Isle. And she said, Joanne, the message is the same everywhere. I said, no.
She said, Joanne, what? I missed the last part. What did she say?
Church. We raised Catholic. I'm a Catholic. Mm-hmm. She said, well, I'm a Catholic too. I said, well, you're not a Catholic if you go to Episcopal Church. Anyway, I said, it's in the Bible. Read the Bible. And you know how sometimes you get so excited you can't think, where in the Bible does it show that the Catholic Church will be formation? But, you know, it's the true religion. So I said it was the Last Supper, and she disagreed with it. She even told me the Pope recognizes the Episcopal Church as one of the most important churches. I don't know. So help me, Patrick. What do I
say? All right. Okay. Why don't we start with the fact that Jesus established a church? We know that much. In Matthew 16:18, he says, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." So we know that there and in Matthew 18:18, Jesus refers specifically to this church that he's building. And we see the church referenced not as like a localized body of people. The word church means an assembly, ekklesia in the Greek. It means an assembly. But that word became associated with the church as such, not just the church present in a particular location. Now, that church that Christ established is the Catholic Church, capital C Catholic. You see the name Catholic being applied to it by St. Ignatius of Antioch as early as the year 107, when he was on his way to Rome to be martyred, and he wrote a series of letters to the different churches he was passing through on his way from what is now southern Turkey, on his way to Rome to be eaten by lions in the amphitheater. So in one of his letters, he refers to the Catholic Church. He says, you know, where the bishop is, there is the Eucharist, there is Jesus, there is the Catholic Church, to paraphrase him. Now, he doesn't explain it. He doesn't say, here's what I mean by that, because you don't see the word Catholic in any explicit way in the New Testament, although Jesus does use the language of Catholicity when he says in Matthew chapter 28 to the apostles, verse 19, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations. So the word Catholic is a compound word from kathos and holos, the two words in the Greek, which combine to form what we would call universal. And you see that universality of this church that Christ established in Matthew chapter 28. You see it elsewhere, but that's a good place to look at. So here we have, in the year 107, St. Ignatius of Antioch, and he's already calling the church the Catholic Church. And what's interesting is that he was a disciple of St. John the Apostle, and he very well may have known St. Peter as well. So he, as he himself says, he received the gospel from the apostles. He learned the faith from the apostles, directly from the apostles. In fact, even in this document, he talks about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And he says, to conflate two passages together, he says, if you meet somebody who doesn't believe, what we profess, namely that the Eucharist is the very body of the Lord, body and blood of the Lord that suffered on the cross. I think he says the word flesh, the very flesh of the Lord that suffered for our salvation on the cross. He says, then stay away from that person because he doesn't believe something that we've been taught by the apostles. And within the context of all this, he's talking about the church as the Catholic Church. And he doesn't explain what he means. And the internal evidence there points to the fact that he didn't need to explain it because people already knew what he meant by the Catholic Church. That's the earliest surviving document that we have in which the church is being called a Catholic Church. But furthermore, his contemporaries did not question him. They didn't say, the what church? What's that? What do you mean the Catholic Church? What does that mean? Not only does he not explain it, which suggests that it was already currently in use, but nobody asks him. Nobody says, what did he mean by that when he said the Catholic Church? So we see the term Catholic being used from the very beginning. And what's interesting is that the Catholic Church was known by certain distinctive qualities. As Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, the church is like a city on a hill. It's like a light in a dark room. Nobody lights a lamp and hides it under a basket, but it's made visible for all in the house. So Jesus made the church visible. You could know it. If you wanted to know where's the Catholic Church, you could know it. You could know it by its structure. You could know it by its doctrines. These peculiarly Catholic doctrines, like the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, which, by the way, when the Episcopal Church, which is just the American branch of the Church of England, in the time shortly after King Henry VIII, when the Puritans got a hold of it, they denied that there was any real presence of Christ because they were under the influence of Calvinism. So there was a long stretch of time when the Church of England emphatically denied the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, among other Catholic teachings. So the problem that your friend has, it seems to me, is that she, number one, doesn't know the Bible very well. She also doesn't seem to know history very well, because the Episcopal Church is nothing more than, as I say, the American branch of the Church of England. And there are affiliated churches that are affiliated with the Church of England, but that's where it all comes from. Well, the Church of England broke with the Catholic Church and denied many of these doctrines. In fact, it lost its apostolic succession because when under King Henry VIII, when the Church of England broke away and it just came into existence because King Henry VIII by fiat said, okay, guess what? Now there's a new church and it's called the Church of England and I'm the head, not the Pope. And they did this thoroughgoing eradication of as much of anything that was Catholic as they possibly could. All of the bishops of England and Wales went into heresy and schism, except for one, St. John Fisher, and he was martyred for his trouble. But all the other bishops, they caved and they went into schism and heresy. And so when these bishops died off, there no longer was any valid holy orders that were being passed down. Pope Leo XIII said as much in a document in which he said that Anglican orders are null and void because they lost the authentic sacraments, and in particular the sacrament of holy orders, because they had gutted the church's the ceremony rather for the ordinations, and thus after these valid bishops died off, they lost apostolic succession. So not only do they not have any organic historical link with the actual Catholic Church, aside from the fact that they were severed from it by King Henry VIII, they also don't have valid Eucharist or valid holy orders. And these are the facts of history. So it seems to me that your friend should do a little more reading. If you want to read a book that was written by a man who actually fought in the English army during the American Revolutionary War, or at least during that time, his name was William Cobbett, and he wrote a book called The Protestant Reformation in England and Ireland. And so he was a couple hundred years removed from the time when it happened, but it is an account from an English Protestant about the history of the Reformation and all the specifics that went into it that formed the Church of England. It was only later, when there was a kind of resurgence of Anglo-Catholicism in the Church of England, that they began to try to assert that the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and by extension these other groups like the Episcopal Church, that, oh, we're really part of the Catholic Church. We're the Anglo branch of the Catholic Church. Then you got the Roman Catholics over there. And that's one reason why I object to the use of the term Roman Catholic, because there is really no such thing as a Roman Catholic. They're just Catholics. You're either a Catholic or you're not a Catholic. And so it was part of the polemic on the part of Church of England polemicists to try to cast themselves as being part of the Catholic Church. And the Catholics were like just the Roman Catholics. And you know who exploded this entire myth was a brilliant man who was a Church of England minister. His name was John Henry Newman, and he was very erudite and very brilliant in many respects. And so he decided, you know what, those Catholics and all their claims about Mary and purgatory and the Mass and all this other stuff, that's all bogus. And I'm going to prove it, he said. I'm going to do a tour de force historical research project and demonstrate by using the church fathers and the early councils. He said, I'm going to show that those Catholics, those Roman Catholics, are wrong, and that the Church of England is really the true Catholic Church. And so he dug in, and he tried, and he tried, and he tried, and after a while he gave up, and he wound up becoming Catholic. And as he himself said in the book that he wound up writing, which is called An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, he said, to become deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And he had just ceased to be Protestant, because he came face to face with the facts of history that the early church, first century, second century, third century, etc., the early church was Catholic with a capital C. The Pope, the bishops, the Mass, the sacraments, all of it. And he couldn't intellectually ignore the evidence, and he realized that the only appropriate and intellectually honest thing that he could do would be to become Catholic. And he did. And he spent the rest of his life actually dealing with these kinds of bogus historical and biblical arguments. So if you want to read his book, An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, it's very helpful. Or read his explanation of why he became Catholic. It's called Apologia Pro Vita Sua, which is Latin for a defense of his life. He's defending himself. This is why I became a Catholic. And he goes into all of these details. Now, I probably have overloaded you, Joanne, with more information than you were bargaining for, but you are in such a strong position, and if with even just some of these details, you can adequately dispatch the arguments that she's raising against you.
Well, I thank you for that. And I stand strong, very strong in my Catholic faith and my, you know, the teachings that I've, you know, had over the years. And again, with Relevant Radio and my parish, you know. So I stand strong. I just wanted something to go to, you know, a go-to that I can say. It's right here.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, if you look up the writings of John Henry Newman, he's St. John Henry Newman now. He was actually made a cardinal. He was a priest. He never was made a bishop, but he was a cardinal in the Catholic Church as a thank you from the Pope for the great work that he had done. But he was a prodigious writer, and he spent his life doing apologetics and showing that the claims of the Episcopal Church, or, you know, really the Church of England, were simply not true. So I would enlist his help. Anyway, thanks, Joanne. I appreciate your phone call very much. Let me just mention one more time. The author of the book that I mentioned a moment ago is William Cobbett, C-O-B-B-E-T-T. And the book is called A History of the Protestant Reformation in England and Ireland. He was a Protestant. And he wrote this book as an historical survey, and he wrote it between the years of 1824 and 1827. And man, does he get into some really heavy-duty details about what actually happened during the Protestant Reformation. There's this sort of romanticized, saccharine pseudo-history of the Protestant Reformation in general, but specifically in England and Wales and Ireland. And he just demonstrates with, you know, the historical evidence that what many people think happened actually didn't happen. And you know, a big part of it was the money that was in it. So when King Henry VIII proclaimed himself to be the head of the Church of England and he broke with Rome, and the reason for it, of course, was that he wanted a divorce. He didn't, you know, he just, it wasn't adding up for him with his wife. So he wanted a divorce, and the Pope said, no, you're validly married. You can't have a divorce. He went through six wives, by the way, and not all of them made it with their heads still attached to their shoulders. But in any case, it was a very unsavory beginning of the Church of England, and a great deal of it picked up momentum when the figures who were close to him realized there's a lot of money here. We are going to confiscate the abbeys. We're going to confiscate their lands. We're going to confiscate the monasteries. We're going to confiscate all the churches. You go through England and you look at these ancient, beautiful castles all throughout England, all throughout the British Isles, and you look at some of these ancient monasteries and things. They're all Church of England now, with one exception, the Castle of Arundel in southern England, that remained Catholic all along. But these were all confiscated by the English crown. It's like, sorry, Catholics, you don't have that church anymore. It's been your church for 500 years, but not anymore. It's our church now. I'm going to veer Cobbett, C-O-B-B-E-T-T. C-O-B-B-E-T-T. Sounds like a rhyme, doesn't it? I want to veer off on something here. And I'm trying to remember. I just had a thought in my head. Cyrus, you distracted me. That's okay, though. The Church of England, Arundel Castle, staying Catholic. Oh, yeah. Okay, I remember now. There's a book that came out about 30-ish years ago called Why Catholics Can't Sing. Check it out, Why Catholics Can't Sing. It was written by a Catholic. And he introduced a very interesting historical detail into this bigger picture about why the state of Catholic liturgical singing has been, in some respects, not very good, and why Catholics can't sing. Now, he himself is a trained, I think he has a PhD in musicology. He's got credentials to back it up. But he opened my eyes to something that had been there in front of me all along, and I never put two and two together until I read his book. And here's the thesis in miniature. Think about what happened. So imagine that you're Catholic and you're in 16th century England, and King Henry VIII says, okay, England has been Catholic for 1,000 years, but not anymore, because I can't get a divorce from the Pope, so I'm going to do it my way. And I proclaim myself the head of the new Church of England. And all of you who are my subjects, which means everybody, you now have to be members of the Church of England. You are not allowed to be Catholic anymore. And if you do, we're going to kill you. You'll be fined. If that doesn't work, you'll be put in prison. If that doesn't work, eventually we're going to kill you. That's how it went down. And so the Catholics had a choice to make. Do I stay faithful to the church, to the Pope, or do I go along to get along? So what happened was he enacted these anti-Catholic laws. And imagine yourself in that situation where your parish church with the beautiful stained glass windows that had been there for 500 years suddenly now is the Church of England. And what I believe his name is Thomas Crowell. I think he's the author of this book called Why Catholics Can't Sing. I could have the authors mixed up. But in any case, here is his thesis. His thesis is that because Catholics were outlaws practically from one day to the next, that in order to practice your Catholic faith, you had to do it secretly. You had to go out in the middle of nowhere in a barn or a clearing in the woods and have Mass, maybe late at night when everyone else was asleep. And that's what the Catholic recusants would do. That term recusant, it refers to those Catholics who wouldn't go along with the new regime and they continued to practice their faith clandestinely. And many of them were caught and killed for their trouble. They were martyred because it was a capital offense. Priests who came in, forget about it. St. Edmund Campion and so many of the other Catholic priests who came and ministered clandestinely in England, they were routinely hanged, drawn, and quartered. And if you saw the movie Braveheart, that's how he dies in the end. Watch that scene if you want to know what all these Catholic folk went through. They were hanged, drawn, and quartered. I won't describe to you what that means. It's pretty grisly. So there were any number of Catholics who had to practice their faith clandestinely. And so simply put, the reason he says that many Catholics are not boisterous, they're not like really loud in their singing, they're not really fervent in the way that they used to be, is because the Protestants were in these formerly Catholic churches. And they were, you know, living it up and having a great time because their religion was the legal one. The Catholics had to be quiet and they had to be secretive. And it kind of became a very hidden and quiet thing. And he said then that passed down so that when the Irish missionaries and others were going to the United States and evangelizing and being bishops and nuns and priests in the United States, they brought with them this kind of Catholic quietude that they had inherited from prior generations. And he says that may very well be why for many Catholics, their faith is something private to them. So it's an interesting historical factor. And if you read that book, you'll get more of it. Anyway, I've got to take a break. I'm overdue, but I'll be right back with more. The number is 888-914-9149. Listen to some Duran Duran while I'm gone, but I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres,
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday.
Coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
You know, I get in trouble when I don't play the song. People will tweet at me, like, you didn't play the song.
Let them hate, Cyrus.
What? You're one of those people that tweet me, where's my song?
You're right. I don't tweet you, I text you. Or I make the high sign to you through the glass. But you know what? If he says Taco Tuesday's his favorite day, he could eat tacos every day. Taco Friday, taco. Well, of course, you want to have fish tacos, right? Or shrimp tacos. That is a funny song. Didn't somebody get offended by that song at one time, too?
Yeah,
they were saying,
yeah,
you're
they
being mean to Mexicans or something.
Right. How, you know, this isn't a Mexican show, so how dare we play Mexican music?
But then I had to play my Mexican race card because I am Mexican.
But technically, do you even need to have the race card to?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
You shouldn't have
fun.
To.
You shouldn't have to. Even poking in, you know, this isn't even poking fun at a
it's
culture.
A glorifying.
That's right.
We're glorifying Mexican cuisine. Everywhere in the world, people love tacos. Or they should, I believe. Let's see. 888-914-9149. I just realized I talked a lot about the Protestant Reformation. You know who else?
You were off to the races with that.
I ran out of time. I overshot the runway with that last break.
Man, Patrick.
Hilaire Belloc.
Oh,
I'm trying to.
Okay.
Let me just get one more thought out. This is a little factoid. Hilaire Belloc, who is a contemporary of G.K. Chesterton, he wrote a very good book. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it, called Characters of the Reformation. And it's, you know, biographical sketches of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and others who were architects, and Henry VIII is in there too, architects of the Protestant Reformation, that is well worth anyone's time to read, to understand a bit more about what really happened and how this revolt against the Catholic Church, and I wouldn't necessarily attribute that to Luther and Calvin, but certainly people like King Henry VIII and others, much of it was motivated by greed. And the fact that there was a lot of money that transferred from things like the lands. That's how the monks would live. They would have rents. People would graze their sheep or they'd grow crops, kind of like tenant farmers. And they would pay the rents, and that would be for the upkeep of the abbey and the food for the monks. And, you know, they were busy hand copying the Bible for many centuries. They would spend a great deal of their time just hand copying scripture parchments so that future generations would have them, and they weren't able to necessarily do the kind of work necessary to bring in the money to feed them and keep everything going. So those lands were hugely valuable, and the rents that were attached to them, and not to mention the buildings and things like that. So that had a lot to do with why there was such a frenzy in places like England and Ireland and Wales when it came to the Reformation. Cyrus, I feel like I preempted you. You wanted to say something. What was
it? No, and it's completely off topic, so.
Then go ahead.
do you know that it's Pride Month?
Yeah.
Yeah, have you been inundated, like beat over the head with a hammer with Pride Month yet? I see it everywhere.
Well, you know where I see it most? This is because I'm on Twitter a lot. There are people who they're colorizing their avatars with the colors of the rainbow as their gesture of solidarity with LGBTQ+. I do see a lot of that. So what do you have in mind? What's the latest?
Oh, when I'm driving, I see, like, when I see is Amazon, you know, celebrating Pride Month and, you know, whatever. It's just over the top. And I have a buddy that lives in LA, and he just texts me. He's like, this is everywhere. I can't get away from it. It's absolutely everywhere. And he sent me a picture of a Pride Whopper.
What?
It's a Pride Whopper. So it must be Burger King because it's a Whopper, okay. Right? I'm pretty sure that's Burger King. And it's, I don't even want to describe it, but it's just a hamburger with a little altercation. Or that's not
alteration.
The right word. Thank you. Alteration. And then this is all a marketing ploy. Like, let's not forget, this is all about making money. It has nothing to do about celebrating anyone or any kind of culture or lifestyle. This is about bottom dollar.
Yeah. And I see now that I now understand there's a double meaning about this particular Pride Whopper.
Do you see it? Did you find it?
Now I understand. So they're making a joke.
Oh, it's not a joke.
No. But I'm sure they're smirking for the people who figure out what this is, what this means. And we're not going to talk about it on the air. But it has a certain meaning that that is in that lifestyle. I'll just leave it at that. I mean, sorry, it was bad enough that I was getting misogyny a dose of misogyny with my hamburger.
Whether you asked for it or not.
That was bad enough. Now I've got the Pride Burger. I'm not going to eat one of those.
This is everywhere. Our kids. I mean, did you see this? What happened in, where was it? Was it in Texas? Yeah, in Dallas. It's in Dallas. Drag your kids to Pride event in Dallas.
I did.
People took their kids to a gay bar and forced them to walk a stage with drag queens and thongs.
It's reprehensible. It's diabolical.
This is blatant child abuse.
Yeah, it really is. And you don't want that on your karmic record.
No, you really don't.
And no.
So when's enough enough?
All I know is the story about Sodom and Gomorrah. I know about that. And I shudder to imagine, you know, if things continue the way they're going. But we trust in the Lord, right? So hope and encouragement. Hope and encouragement. Yeah. Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. So that's what I want to stand on. Keep my eyes focused there. And as the world turns, things will come and go. So we just have to keep pressing forward.
That's good advice. I do believe.
Can we stop with the misogyny on the hamburgers? I mean, just that alone would be a
step forward. Your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny.
If I'm ever elected president, that's going to be the first thing I do. No more misogyny on the hamburgers or anything else.
I'm writing you in.
I am so unelectable. I am like the most unelectable guy. All the opposition would have to do is just play this program. And half the country would say, no way, I'll never vote for that guy.
Not that guy.
No. All right, let's continue. Let's go to Jake in Gilbert, Arizona. Good morning, Jake.
Good morning, Patrick. I had a question regarding reading habits. I know when I was first coming into the Catholic Church, I had a lot of free time. I was doing a lot of reading, and I do really enjoy reading. Since then, right now, working, my schedule's very busy with other commitments, trying to make time for prayer. And by the end of the year, I'm going to be married, looking to start a family.
Wow.
Knowing, of course, that you yourself have a large family, you were working a lot, especially early on, and you managed to find time to read. I was wondering how you were able to make the time to read. What was your reading schedule like?
Oh, well, I mean, it doesn't sound like a very interesting topic, but if it's of interest to you, I'll share a little bit, Jake. First of all, congratulations. When is your big day?
Well, the big day is December 30th, right at the end of this year.
Fantastic. Well, I wish and pray that God will give you and your wife many happy years together and that he'll bless you with many children. Okay, so my reading habits, I have to make a conscious effort to read books and not look at the phone or the computer. And so I do. So part of my daily habits is that I read, and I try to read at least for a couple hours a day. How do I make time? You know how it is. You just make time. You just devote some time during the day to the things that are important. A lot of the reading has to do with being prepared for this program. So I have a lot to stay ahead of, and not just current events, but I also have to remain as knowledgeable as possible. There are people who are far more knowledgeable than I am, but I have to remain as knowledgeable as I can be in order to adequately help people with questions that they have. So necessarily that involves a lot of reading. So for me, it's just a matter of discipline, just to make time to read. I try to be systematic. I try to read a wide variety of things. But in terms of like from day to day, I want to make sure that I put in at least an hour or two of reading from a book, not from my phone, so that I can fulfill that. Now, some days I have the luxury of being able to read more if I have more time, which I enjoy doing. But that's really simple. It's just what I try to do. And my whole life, reading has always been something I've enjoyed, so it's not a chore for me. I know for some people it is a chore, but for me, it's just a great pleasure to be able to sit down with a good book and read and read and read and read. I really enjoy it. So I'm not saying this as if I'm doing something unusual or something heroic or anything. I just enjoy doing it, so I make time for it. So that's my take. That's my formula.
Yeah, well, thank you. I know definitely I notice as my life gets busier, making that commitment's a lot harder, so that's why I figured I'd ask someone else who I know has probably been a lot busier than I've ever been thus far.
Well, perhaps so. I have been busy, that's for sure, but chances are your life will get at least as busy once children start coming. I think it's like anything else. You make time for what's important. You know, what did Jesus say? You know, for where your heart is, there will your treasure be. Or where your treasure is, there will your heart be. You can look at it both directions. So we make time for what's important. People make time to watch TV if that's what's important to them. Or they make time to, you know, do whatever. So if reading is important, you'll make time for it. That's really the only way I can think of how to explain it. And I think people would do well to read and read more than to just look at electronic pixels on a screen. There's something about the tactile quality of holding a book and flipping pages that it just, for some reason, it just seems to stick more. So anyway, those are my thoughts on that. Thanks, Jake, and I wish you all success in marriage. Let's go to Ramsey, Minnesota now and talk to Sam. Hello, Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hello there.
Hi, Patrick. Can you hear me?
I can now. Yes. Welcome.
Hello. Great. Sorry, I think my phone is muted. I just wanted to start by saying if you ran for president, I would totally vote for you.
Thank you. I do mean it, though, when I say I am unelectable. I think just being a Catholic who's serious about the faith would be enough for people to say, no way.
Fact.
So.
Well, I just had a question. There's been a little bit of a crisis in my family lately. My sister-in-law, a couple of years ago, she started dating a Muslim man, and none of us knew about this. She was raised Catholic. Our whole family is devoutly Catholic, and she ended up getting engaged to this man and is now married, and we didn't know anything about this until they were engaged, and it's just been a kind of a difficult time, and I've really been struggling with, you know, my wife and I pray for her and her new husband every day to try to help them return to the faith. And I was just wondering if you had any words of wisdom or guidance or any maybe resources you could point us to try to help help convert them back to the true faith of Catholicism.
I do. I would recommend that you put her in touch with Father Zachariah Boutros. So Zachariah, Z-A-K-A-R-I-A, and his last name is spelled B-O-U-T-R-O-S. Now, he is a Coptic priest, but he's, you know, he teaches the faith in a Catholic way, and he's a native Arabic speaker, but he also speaks English. I believe he resides in Canada, if I'm not mistaken, and he goes toe-to-toe with Muslim imams. He debates them. He refutes them. He's an expert on the Quran. He's an expert at, you know, doing apologetics with Muslims. And he's very knowledgeable. He's very effective. So I would go to his, or send her to his website, fatherzachariah.net. F-A-T-H-E-R, zachariah.net. And there he has videos, he has books, he has other resources. So it's a real cornucopia of things that he has available. And is her husband, is he like from another country? Is he from the Middle East?
So they live out on the West Coast, kind of out in Arizona now. And I believe, I haven't met him. They got married across the country. None of us were really invited or anything. But I know that, I think he said his family is from Iraq originally, and they moved to the United States to get away from Saddam Hussein and all that, you know, horribleness. They've lived here for, I think he's lived here most of his life, if I'm not mistaken.
So chances are he speaks Arabic. And so when he sees this man speaking Arabic and refuting the imams, refuting the Muslim apologists, I think that will get his attention. So that would be the place I would send them. Go there, and I think that if they're willing to at least look at this and consider his arguments, I think that it will help them see that at least that she has made a serious mistake, and she can come back.
I really appreciate that. Do you know any advice on just how to approach the subject with them? Because I know they don't seem very open to the possibility, and I mean, any thoughts on how we could try to bridge that gap?
Could you say it again? Do I have a thought about what?
A thought on just how to start that conversation, because neither of them seem very open to it. And just, you know, advice on how to bridge that gap, just to how to start the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just to kind of recap what I said, I think if you were to send her a link to this website, FatherZacharia.net, that would be how I would start the conversation and just say, you know, I realize that you left the Catholic Church and you became Muslim. Here's a man who is Catholic, and he's a Coptic Catholic, and he has some things to say about Islam and about Jesus. And wouldn't it be worth your time to consider what he has to say? I would start there. You can also find his videos on YouTube. So maybe you can grab a YouTube video, watch it yourself, and then send her a link and say, what do you think about this? Just ask her, what do you think about this? Let's have a discussion. That could be a good way to go about it. I hope it bears good fruit. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, back to it. Let's go to Sue in Campbell, California. Hi, Sue.
Hi there.
Hi.
So my question is, I was at the confessional on Saturday, and about five or six of us were turned away because they ran out of time. And I believe it was what you had mentioned before. It's knowing confessional etiquette. And I just don't know what to do because I just think it's going to happen again and again. Yeah. And so I just wanted to know how to either approach the church that I go to or just the individual priest. I just wanted to know if you had any suggestions.
Yeah, I know this will sound flippant, and I don't mean it to sound flippant. I would just say get there early, so that way you'll be, you know, up in line, maybe even the first in line. This has happened to me before, too.
I just wish, you know, I was actually going to print out, you know, confessional etiquette and just hand it to the priest and go, can you put this in the bulletin? There's actually a little container near the confessional where you can put bulletins or what have you. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice just to put that there? Just something so that, because I think the majority of people don't realize, I certainly didn't realize until you had mentioned it on one of your programs. Mm-hmm. And so, I just think what resonated most with me was when you said, this is not the time for spiritual guidance. This is for primarily for confession. And I just thought that was such a great message because it helped me just keep it short and sweet or short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you for that, Sue. Yeah, I concur. So under ordinary circumstances, when there are people in line for confession, it is bad form if you go into confession and you take forever to go to confession. Now, sometimes someone needs a lot of time because there are a lot of sins to bring up, or there's maybe the person is not particularly forthright and the priest has to ask a few discreet questions to understand more clearly what the person's confessing. But aside from that, it is not the time for spiritual direction. And what happens is, what I was going to say earlier, Sue, is that this has happened to me before. And it's very frustrating, and it actually, you run the risk of maybe committing another sin, which is to be furious with the person who's in there for 30 minutes, and now you can't go to confession before you go to Mass. That's really a problem. So if people had the sense of, I need to go to confession, and I'll go in, and I'll take care of it, and then not prolong it so that the person behind me can go, and the person behind that person can go, that's looking out for other people. There are ways to have spiritual direction in confession, but you would want to arrange that with the priest. Can I come to you for spiritual direction in confession? And he'll be happy to arrange that for you. But as a general rule, in the parish confessional times, the best practice is to go in, make your confession, receive absolution, and go. And that way you don't have people who are maybe who really need to go to confession and they can't go because you've taken up all the time. So.
And I appreciate that. That's just a really good reminder for your audience and myself as well. Do you have any suggestions on how I can approach?
You could do what you suggested, although I don't know that the priest is likely to post something. Because many of the people who are going to church on Sunday who might see that in the area that you just described, many of them don't go to confession or they don't go to confession frequently. So if there's going to be any kind of a advisory note, it might be even in the confessional itself, perhaps a little placard that would say, you know, everyone is welcome. Please be brief so that you don't make other people delayed. Something like that could be there, although I've never seen that before. So maybe it's not something that the average priest would want to do. I don't know. But nonetheless, if you get there early enough, then you don't run that risk. You could talk to the parish priest about it. And my sense of it is that a parish priest who's cognizant of this issue, he would say to somebody who's taking a very long time, well, there are other people waiting behind you. Is there anything else that we need to cover and kind of help that person along? That would be a good pastoral
thing. That's a great idea. Yeah. That's a great idea. And although he asked me, well, although I'm not sure if I can mention this, Thomas is fantastic. Your caller screener, and I'm sure he's just turning bright red right now, but he's really fantastic. And he didn't want to be acknowledged, but, you know, it's me. So I just think people that are in customer service positions, such as himself, really need to be acknowledged. So I just wanted to just let you know. He was a great hire, just as you were. So
we feel the same way. We really like Thomas. He's doing a great job. So we're more than happy to acknowledge him.
See, Thomas? See what happens here? All right. Well, thank you so much, Patrick.
Thanks,
and I will definitely approach the next time I'm in there. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you. Appreciate that. Way to go, Thomas. Way to go. They love you. They really love you. Let's go to, where are we going to go? Let's go to Francis in Sedona, Arizona. Good morning, Francis.
Yes, Patrick, how you doing?
I am well, thanks.
Good. Listen, when I was in 1967, I was stationed over in Germany, and then I went on leave to go to England.
Okay.
And I'm saying, whoops, I got to go to Mass. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I'm only 21 years old at the time, I'm saying, geez, I want to make sure I go to a Catholic church and not a Church of England. You know, so I'm looking around. And then all of a sudden, I saw a picture of Pope Paul VI in the front of the church. Mm-hmm. And I got, wow, there must be a Catholic church. So I went in and I went to Mass. And everything looked, you know, pretty normal for a Catholic church. And I was just wondering, was that really a Catholic church, even though they had a picture of Pope Paul VI in the front door?
Well, there's no way for me to know for sure, Francis, but my assumption is that it probably was, because I've been to England many times. I've been in and out of Anglican churches here and there, and I've never seen a picture of the Pope, any Pope, in an Anglican church. So I think that alone is sufficient reason to know that you were in a Catholic church.
Right, because I didn't know whether the Catholic Church was, when it came into effect, where they started accepting Catholic churches again in England. You know.
Yeah, when the anti-Catholic penal laws were relaxed and eventually lifted, it did permit the Catholic Church to begin building churches again and resuming a kind of normal Catholic life. That took a long time before it got to that point. But one thing is for sure is that any church in England that's over 500 years old, and that's a lot of them, used to be Catholic. And so it was confiscated by the Church of England when Henry VIII broke from the church itself. That's one thing you can count on. But that's how I would look at that. Thanks for the call, Francis. I appreciate it. How about Carol now in Yorkville, Illinois? Good morning, Carol.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question regarding my first granddaughter high school graduate living in the city of Chicago. Parents, her mother is Catholic due to she's our daughter. Father, not, but has attended Mass her whole life. But kind of shaky grounds with the faith, not real strong. Could you recommend a book, something that might help her lose what she has. You know, so many kids, they go to college and they quit going to church. She's going to be in Chicago. That's where they live. So, you know, it's a terrible place to, you know, an easy place to lose your faith. Let's put it that way. Is there something that would come to mind that would just help her to keep what she has and want to know more?
I think so. One book that I've liked, it's a classic book. It's called The Faith Explained by Leo J. Treese, T-R-E-S-E. And it's, okay. I don't know, it's got to be at least 50 years old, but it's very good, very to the point. Bishop Fulton Sheen wrote a book. I believe the exact title is Life is Worth Living. And it's not only an explanation of the faith, but also, you know, why are we here at all? Why does God have us here? We're here to know him, love him, and serve him in this life so we can be happy with him in the life to come. And so if she has a clear understanding or a clearer understanding of what her purpose in life is, that will help her focus her mind and her energies on things like her faith in God and prayer and such. Not to the exclusion of other things in life. There are plenty of other things that we have to attend to, but if you put God first, all these other things are going to fall into place. So maybe those
That's
two books,
right.
Fulton Sheen and Leo J. Treese, The Faith Explained.
Okay, The Faith Explained. Leo J. Treese, T-R-I-S-T-E?
No, T-R-E-S-E. T-R-E-S-E. Sounds like a rhyme, doesn't it? I'm out of time, but thank you, Carol. I appreciate it. My thanks to all of you who have called. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. In the meantime, please do pray for me. I really mean it. Pray for me, and I'll pray for you. God bless you.
I'm Lucky Day.
I'm Ned Niederlander.
I'm Dusty Bottoms. And together we're
the Three Amigos.